Okay, Diana, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm very excited to have a nice conversation today.
Yeah, thank you. So we want to, or at least initially, I would like to start at the conference you guys are organizing. So I was a very lucky guest to the original or the first iteration of the Indonesian Bitcoin conference, which was held in Sanur in Bali almost 18 months ago now. So September will be 2 years. Yeah, wow. It goes so quick. And it was just an awesome experience. So what has happened since then? And what are you guys organizing for later this year?
All right. Where do I start? I'm so excited. Whenever we talk about the conference, I get overexcited. So yeah, we are here for another round of Indonesia Bitcoin conference. And last time it was hosted by Dea, our Indonesian friend. And this time Bitcoin Indonesia is taking over because Dea is pregnant.
Waiting
no way. Baby. Yay.
I didn't know. Congratulations, Dea, if you're ever listening to this. That's awesome.
And we really want to have a conference. So we decided, yes, of course, we'll do it. And now I'm the main organizer of this whole event.
Okay,
and we're
cool.
Trying to do things a little bit differently because we believe Bali is such a special place. And it would be a shame if people just come for a conference. So what we are doing is we will turn Bali into a Bitcoin island and we will celebrate Bitcoin Week Bali. So a whole week of lots of exciting side events for the community to gather, to meet each other, to explore the island, to do some sports together. So we will have a women's brunch, some paddle nights, maybe some yoga classes. We'll have a spa day after the conference day, island exploration. So we really want that people have the best experience and really get a feeling of what it is to be a Bitcoiner here in Bali.
Cool.
And then the conference itself will be 1 day conference. It's the main event of this whole week. And we try to make it a little bit more grassroots because what we are doing with Bitcoin Indonesia and the Bitcoin House in Bali is focused on the local people. So we also want to get the local people involved in the conference. Ticket prices for locals will be very low so that they can actually attend. We'll also have an Indonesian stage to give also all these great Indonesian educators and builders a stage where they can talk about their projects and discuss what they are interested in. And it will be a very Balinese experience. So we make it smaller than last time. Last time it was in a very fancy hotel. But this time it will be at the Bitcoin House. We rent the whole community hub. And yeah, 3 stages, lots of workshops, lots of opportunities to connect with each other. Not so much talking, more connecting. That's our goal.
Cool. Sounds awesome. I've been very lucky to go to, I guess, a varying pedigree of events over the last few years. But obviously, I went to the first one. As you say, it was a 2-day event. We were in a big hotel in Bali somewhere. I've been to Bitcoin Alive in Sydney a couple of times. So I've been lucky also to be the MC of these events too. So that's an amazing role where I get to meet all these people that I've generally kind of, you know, stumbled across online and like learning about Bitcoin. Like, what is this stuff? And suddenly you find you've got a microphone, you're on a stage and you're introducing people. You're like, whoa, like, I envisaged that happening, but it happened much faster than I expected. And it's like, oh, is that actually manifestation happening in real time? And it's this kind of crazy thing. But that sounds amazing. And so the other thing, you mentioned so many things I want to ask about, but just to stick on the conference that's upcoming then. So what your recommendation is come for at least a week and take a holiday in Bali and test out these different events that are going on, or equally, you know, find places that you want to go and visit. As maybe you go with your partner or some friends, because Bali's awesome. I've been lucky to spend now many, many, many trips. And you know, if you're into surfing, if you're into food, if you're into hiking, like one of the best parts actually of the previous experience I had as the MC of the Indonesia Bitcoin conference was actually on the final night. We got up at like 2 o'clock in the morning and took a bus. And is it Mount Batur? Is that, have I said that correct? Yes. So we hiked to the top of the dormant volcano and saw the sunrise. And actually, having spent a couple of days at the conference in and around a lot of the other guest speakers, or you know, maybe met them in a very formal kind of environment, which is like literally on a stage with a microphone, or with like a, you know, a lanyard on and a name and stuff. Suddenly you're just like hiking up a hill. And yeah, it was such a nice shift in energy and environment to spend time with people that you would just never have otherwise met, because obviously Bitcoin's for everyone. And that's what you see at these events.
Yeah, 100% I agree. I always think that the side events are the most fun part of a conference, because if you're in a more casual environment, then you really build connections with other people. Mm. And this is what we're trying to achieve here.
And so the event itself will be hosted at Bitcoin House Bali. Is that right?
Yes, cool. Exactly.
And so this is a location I have yet to visit. It wasn't built when I last came to Bali. I'm sure that I threw some sats in the direction of the project on the Gazer Fund website at some point. Teach us about Bitcoin House Bali.
All right. So we started with a project called Bitcoin Indonesia after the last conference, because me and some friends, we had the feeling this conference is so much fun and great, but somehow we need to get the local people more involved. So we need to make Bitcoin education for the local people. So we started Bitcoin Indonesia, focusing on creating content in Bahasa Indonesia, and running workshops, going to schools, just providing the basic education about Bitcoin and making it more accessible for the local people. That was our mission, that we basically have a conference every day, but for the local people.
Mm, cool.
And then we were very inspired by what Bitcoin Beach is doing, and also the guys in Roatan with their education center. And we always had the dream of also having a space for the community. And then Bali magic happened, and we met someone on a party who was building this community hub here in Canggu, and who was looking for communities that educate people, that have some kind of sustainability approach. And we orange-pilled him, and he offered us the first community space, and cool, said, okay, Bitcoin guys, please come. Yeah. Please come here.
Have you heard about this thing called Bitcoin by any chance? He's like, what is it? There's hundreds of us, and it's amazing. Okay,
cool. Yes, it was so fun. And he's a very, very smart guy. He's an engineer, and he, like, within a few hours, he understood what our mission is and why Bitcoin is so important. And that's why he offered the space to us. So we basically turned a big mining container into an education center and community hub. And we want that people have a space where they can learn, where they can ask questions, where they can make mistakes, and just have a safe environment to learn and grow. So we have a little library there, they can rent out books, and we have lots of hardware wallets and mining devices so that they can actually like see and touch them and try them out. We run workshops for beginners, for kids, for developers. Lots of meetups are happening there. We are teaching them my first Bitcoin. And it became just a nice space to hang out and to meet people.
And it seems then a very natural location to host an event. What yes. I guess I'm struggling to get my head around is like it really was like a proper hotel job. How many people do you expect to come this time around?
We're targeting around 250 people because we want to make it smaller and more exclusive and more intimate. So it will be definitely less people than last time. But we are providing all these side events. So if more people are interested in joining, of course, they can attend the side events. But the conference itself will be smaller than last time.
Cool. And that makes it much easier to organize as well.
Yes,
not that it's not going to be a lot of work. Well, that was the intention. And now you've actually got a 7-day event.
Yes, the idea was, okay, yes, dear, we take over the conference. No problem. We will just do one conference day, very small, very easy.
Yeah.
And now when you start something and you're so passionate about it, it gets bigger and bigger. And now we're having this full week of events. And it's crazy, but also it's so much fun. I love it.
And so teach me, Diana, about, let me give you an example.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm correct, his name was Ronnie. So shout out to Ronnie. And he was a cab driver in Bali, and he drove me from Sanur down to the south, where I was meeting with my wife and kids after mm-hmm. the event. And I took his number and we texted a bit, and maybe he picked me up one more time. I can't remember what happened, but inevitably you're kind of in orange pilling mode anyway, right? And so you're like, I'm here because I'm at a Bitcoin conference. And he's like, what's that? And you just start talking to people, right? And the local Indonesian rupee obviously is inflating just like any other fiat currency. And there's Indonesia's the largest democracy in the world or something. Is that, am I going completely mad?
Democracy.
Yeah. But what is, there's some crazy stats to get thrown around, but it's a massive country.
It's the fourth most populous country in the world.
There you go. Fourth. And democracy wasn't right. Absolutely not. But because I even met like the trade minister and stuff at the event. I had to introduce him on the stage and stuff. I can't remember his name now. But he was a very nice guy. And you're like, wow, imagine what it would be like, a country this big where financial services, they actually function better than I think people realize. But there's still a massive amount of the population that might not even have access to a bank account. And equally, the average person just doesn't have savings. And Bitcoin's a savings technology. It's permissionless. You can sign up. As long as you've got an internet connection, you know, you can have a wallet in minutes and you can send, receive, and store value. So what does it feel like on the ground in Bali for Balinese when it comes to Bitcoin?
It's difficult. So Bali was originally a Bitcoin island around 2014. All the people decided that Bitcoin is the money that they want to use, right? There were so many foreigners coming here. Was very open-minded, and there was a big community. There were many, many merchants that accepted Bitcoin. You could go to Indomaret and just buy Bitcoin. It was crazy. Like, the adoption here was so, so big. But then the central bank decided that that's not the way they want to go, because if nobody wants to use the Indonesian rupiah in their own country, and there's no other country that's using Indonesian rupiah, they have a problem. So they teamed up with the national police and they went from shop to shop and shut down everybody.
Wow.
And right now the situation is that, or the legal situation is that, you are not allowed to use any other currency besides the Indonesian rupiah to make payments. So even if you use the US dollar or euro, stablecoin, Bitcoin, whatever you want, as a form of payment, then you can go to prison up to 2 years.
Wow. And does that get enforced?
Sometimes, yes. Wow. Especially, so I would argue that especially foreigners have to be cautious to not get deported. So maybe you don't end up in jail, but it's very likely that you have to fly home or you have to bribe someone to stay in the country.
Interesting. Yeah, because I remember now I had to sign paperwork as part of my visa to state that I was on a business trip rather than just coming in as a tourist. That's probably standard practice, perhaps, but it's more just that now you're telling me this, I'm like, oh, okay, so what, we're going to turn up in Bali and start paying in Bitcoin and, you know, boom. I mean, that's a very, very serious penalty for using free market money. Wow.
Yes, and that just shows that they are afraid.
Yes, of course.
And it brings the people into a very bad situation because inflation is rising. Currency restrictions are getting tougher and tougher. Banking system is super weak. There are so many banking scams and banking fees are high. If you travel from one island to the other, you cannot take your money with you. And CBDCs are coming. Like, there are so many problems where Bitcoin is the easy solution. And these kind of laws are just very bad for the local people. However, the community is always stronger, in my opinion. So we came up with a very nice solution, which makes Bitcoin usage on a daily basis legal. So we brainstormed a lot. We consulted a lawyer and we found a loophole in the law. So we are now onboarding merchants in Bali.
Cool.
And the way it works is they have to use the FEDI app. They have to join the Indonesian Federation. And with this, they become part of a closed system.
Yes.
And we don't say you pay in Bitcoin. We just say you redeem Bitcoin. So basically, Bitcoin becomes our community points, Starbucks points, at Starbucks.
Yeah.
The Starbucks is not a currency, right? It's not a threat.
Yeah, it's your air miles or your club card points. Yes, exactly.
Exactly. And our club points are Satoshis. Very easy.
Wow. Wow. How interesting. And so number one, like the free market always wins. So like great example of that. So there's a workaround. Of course, there's a workaround. So now it's about distributing that information in a suitable way that doesn't get the loophole closed, but enables people to get better access to what's, you know, a transformative technology.
Yeah.
And it strikes me actually, Diana, I remember so well as I was meeting all these people and I was watching all of these different, you know, because as the MC over 2 days, I sat at the front of the conference the whole time. I had to introduce people on and off the stage. And it was actually quite funny in hindsight that it was like, I did it on my own for 2 days. There's a lot more stuff to do than I originally realized. And that's okay. I did it because it was an amazing experience and I learned so much. But it was, you know, there was communities there from not just Indonesia itself, but obviously you had lots of people like myself who were based in Australia or New Zealand who'd come up for it. But then it was actually the rest of Southeast Asia. So you had people from Singapore, Vietnam, Malaysia, Philippines, and Thailand. I got to meet all these guys and they all had respective kind of mini economies in their own countries. And you're talking about millions and millions of people living in areas with pretty poor financial infrastructure at best. And I just got this incredible thing. It's like, God, you've got to kill every single one of us to kill this thing, Bitcoin.
Yes.
Right? Like the cat is out the bag. It is being used. When you get someone who comes along and says, oh, Bitcoin, you can't even use it to buy a coffee. It's like, well, I'm not going to bother talking to you about it because you don't know what you're talking about. Go to a Bitcoin conference in Asia and see what's actually happening in all these different countries. So I'm sure that they've also faced difficulties from local government and they probably found similar workarounds. How is that process going then of introducing that? And what's it been like using Fedi in particular?
What's the benefit of using Fedi?
What's it been like, just the experience of using Fedi?
For us, Fedi is a game changer because it's the only way right now how we can use Bitcoin on a day-to-day basis here in Bali. Wow. It was
And can you explain to me why that's the case? So the law is obviously pretty clear. Like you can't use anything but the rupiah to pay. And so by using the Fedi infrastructure, you're basically you're almost like you're a derivative of the money. So you're not actually using it. But then the way that Fedi's built, to my understanding, this is what I'd like to learn more about, like how does Fedi actually work?
Mm-hmm.
Is that it's because it's a bearer asset. They're able to, it's just much more effective, essentially.
Yes.
What's your experience with Fedi been like and how does it work?
So it works like this, that we have the Indonesian Federation. So in Fedi is built for communities. The whole idea is to empower communities. So we have an Indonesian community federation inside the Fedi app, and you can only access this federation via an invite link or if somebody shows you the QR code. So it's a closed system. And this
I actually think I was part of it at some point. We were encouraged to download it at the conference.
Yes, we were pioneering this at the conference, right? And with this, we make sure that it's not an open system and therefore not a threat for the Indonesian rupiah because it's only for the community. And we just send Bitcoin within the community from one person to the other. And also merchants can be part of this community. So in this case, we just limit the usage basically a little bit for Bitcoin in Bali. And we say it's only for Bali. So we try to focus this a little bit and to grow the, we don't say circular economy, we say closed loop system.
Yes.
But we grow it in Bali and see how it works. So it's nice. I mean, Fedi is a very new solution. And of course, there are lots of bugs sometimes. And we report this and we somehow develop the application together with Fedi, which is a very exciting experience. And they've been very supportive. So it's just an exciting journey to try this out and to find ways to make it work somehow. And one benefit of Fedi is also that you can add mods. like little applications to your federation. So for example, we have a list of all the merchants inside, and these are little icons where you can tap on, or you can redirect to an online ATM, for example, something like this. Everything that's valuable for the community, you can customize within the federation.
Cool. Gosh, it gets my brain firing away. But I met Obi only very briefly at the conference. Awesome to meet a character like that, to be honest, who's, you know, built multiple businesses in the Bitcoin space.
Yes.
And he was literally there taking product feedback. Mm-hmm. So he was watching people using the technology and was writing down as much as he could about what was working and what wasn't working. It was actually very impressive to see.
Yeah.
The speed and the quality of the work. Like, he was operating at this level. You're like, fuck me, this guy's not screwing around. But so cool to see the traction consequently. I had no idea this was the case. What an awesome story to have kind of stumbled across.
Yeah.
And it just really just hammers home how, you know, again, anyone that like, well, our Bitcoin won't work because it can't scale. You just cannot get enough transactions through those small blocks. It's like, yes, okay, that might be true in terms of actual throughput, but you can create additional layers. And this is essentially an example of that.
Yeah.
And it's not Lightning. It's something completely different that is actually great for the use case that you guys have, where you can call it, as you say, closed loop. Gosh, how fascinating. And so for people then that are thinking about making a trip up to Bali, talk a little bit about some of the additional events that are happening around the conference.
Mm-hmm. So we will start with Bitcoin Educators Academy from MITH. And they are coming to teach us, our team, some community leaders from Indonesia, how to be better Bitcoin educators. And I think this is very exciting to level up our skills, because so many people, they understand Bitcoin, but for them it's so hard to explain it in a simple way and to find like easy examples. So I think this session will be very valuable for us and for the community. And then on the 4th of September, we will have some surfing, yoga, women's brunch, maybe a speed dating. And this is why not? We will call it proof of love.
Yeah.
So there are so many people that are single and are looking for the right person in the Bitcoin space. So maybe it's a nice or fun way to.
I think it's a great idea. People, you know, now people are going to get on the plane from all over the place to be heading to beautiful Bali to come and play that game. And so, Diana, I'm intrigued as to then, so yourself personally, so you mentioned just before the call that home was originally Germany. Mm-hmm. How did you end up in Bali and how did you end up so into Bitcoin?
So I learned about Bitcoin the first time, I think around 2017. And my boyfriend told me about this new thing where we should put some money in to retire early. Unfortunately, we also put lots of money in other coins. So that was not a good deal. During COVID, we had lots of time to learn, to think about it, and to fall down the rabbit hole, because we noticed, wow, all the coins went to zero while Bitcoin is still there. Why is that? And also it was a time, I think, where we all changed a lot and thought about the system and government and inflation and all of these topics. So it was a very transformative experience for us. And back then I was working in the management consultancy. I was like super depressed, hated my job, was working nonstop, late in the evening. And somehow I thought, wow, there should be more in life than this. I'm so young. I want to see the world. I want to have a happy life. And at that time we decided, okay, we need to change something. We will quit everything. We will quit our jobs. We will sell everything that we have. We'll put everything in Bitcoin and we will start traveling and see how other people in the world are living.
I'm starting to smile. Like, how epic.
And one of the first destinations was Bali, because before COVID, we were in Bali and the first time, and we felt so in love with this place. So our dream was always to one day come back and check if it's really that beautiful, how we had it in mind. And yes, it's still so beautiful. So we spent, I think, around 2 months here, and then we continued traveling, and we went to lots of other countries in Southeast Asia mainly, and we learned how people are actually using Bitcoin. So, for example, if you go to the Philippines and Boracay, they're using Bitcoin on a day-to-day basis just as a form of payment. And that was so inspiring to see that people don't see Bitcoin as a form of investment, but as a freedom tool and as a like daily money. Long story short, we continued our travel, but at one point we said, okay, why are we doing this? We actually already found our place. Let's go back to Bali and settle there for some time and see where this takes us. And then we got involved into the conference. We started writing a book about Bitcoin for Indonesia. We really wanted to bring Bitcoin back to Bali and to create a nice environment for ourselves, but also for the people here, of course. Mm. And now it's 3 years.
Awesome. and not to, I don't want to fast forward through all of this, but just to take you back to that point where you're like, hang on, so it's probably the height of COVID. You're in Germany somewhere. It's probably winter. And you're like, I'm indoors. I'm being told that I can't go anywhere or do anything. And I'm in a job I fucking hate.
Yes.
Like, just take me back to that moment, because so many people have been there and some choose to change and others don't. Yeah. What was your, like, how did you decide?
It was difficult because it was my like first serious job. Before that, I was always like self-employed. I was founding my own companies, but somehow I had the feeling or like the social pressure that after my master's, I have to go into the consultancy business, wear a nice suit, drive an expensive car, and like make everybody proud. Mm. And it was interesting because my family and friends, they were like looking up to me. Wow, you're doing amazing. You have everything that you need, right? You have this nice apartment. You're in a relationship. You have a nice car. You have a good job. And I was like the saddest inside. Like never before I felt so bad.
Well, like because, waking up in the morning, just like, oh my God, what am I doing?
Yes. And then you try to pretend to be someone that you're not. People ask me to lie to customers, to fake numbers, to pretend I have knowledge about agriculture or automotive industry. Like, I just come from university. How should I know about agriculture now? So they faked my profile all the time. And it was like, come on, this is not what I want. And I was talking to my boss as well. And I was like, how can you lie to people? For me, it's very difficult. And he was like, yeah, no worries. After some time, you get used to it. And that was my wake up call. And I was like, No, I don't want to become like you. I have to get out here as fast as possible.
Cool.
Yeah.
I love that phrase, Jana. Action leads to clarity.
Yeah.
So it's only through the doing that you're like, oh my God, red lights everywhere. Yeah. And sometimes you can like ignore it. Like, that's a red flag, but I'm going to, you know, I'm making money, you know, so I'm going to ignore it. Or, oh, there's another red flag, but I got the car, so I'm just going to ignore it a bit more. And yes. you're compromising against what your true purpose is, whatever that might be. And the coolest part is basically that moment where you're like, all right, enough.
Yeah.
And you go and resign and everyone's like, you've lost it. And you're like, yep, I've lost it and I'm off. Yeah. And here you are. You know, I can feel the energy. You're smiling away. What a big change. And so what are some of the things then that you really cherish now that you knew you would never have got?
Not sure if I understand the question correctly.
So if you'd stayed in that job doing what you were doing back then, what are some of the things that you get to do now that you definitely wouldn't be doing?
I couldn't drink coconuts. I couldn't go to the beach, basically. And like, own the morning. I think owning the morning is so valuable. If you wake up and you decide how you start the day, this is very, very important to me. I couldn't change people's life in a positive way. Right now, we're having this nonprofit organization, and we really feel the impact, and we really feel that we are going into the right direction. While working in Germany, somehow felt like it was all going down, and you just try to swipe up the mess that's already there. So, my life has improved drastically.
And so, how much of that is? How do I phrase this question? Would you have been able to make those decisions if it wasn't for Bitcoin?
No.
Cool. And explain to us then what Bitcoin has enabled you to do.
So for me, Bitcoin is freedom in many, many ways, because thanks to Bitcoin, I have a freedom of choice where I want to live and how I want to spend my time. And Bitcoin gave me lots of time where I don't needed to work, because Bitcoin was working for me. So keeping my money in Bitcoin allowed me to travel, to take time for myself, to work on myself. I have this new table where you can adjust the height, and now it was just going up.
It's saying hi.
So I think that these are the most important things, that it gave me freedom to move wherever I want and take my wealth with me, and also to buy me basically time to travel and to explore things and to talk to people and to work on myself and to find a way where I want to put my energy in. And now, like, when I learned about Bitcoin deeply, I knew I want to spend my time on Bitcoin, because for me it was the most valuable thing I can put my energy on. And because I was, I was concerned about so many things in this world, like inequality. I was concerned about the environment. I was concerned about inflation, that people are not happy anymore. So many things. And then it all came down to the money system. So I knew I wanted to work on Bitcoin, and I'm happy that I found my, people call it Ikigai, but it really feels like this here in Bali.
Fantastic. And well done, because it's not without a curious nature. It's not without a sense of willingness to take risk. It's not without risk itself, right? I mean, what if you were wrong, right?
Yeah.
You could have bought all this Bitcoin and it could have just disappeared. And you may not have found this happier place.
Yeah. I have to admit, I come from a very privileged background. So even if I would have quit my job and put my money in Bitcoin and travel and then notice, oh shit, this is not going in the right direction, I could have always go back home into a like German security system where the government pays you unemployment money, will give you a flat, and will take care of you, right? So for me, it was, yes, I took some risk, but I don't want to, like, well, not no, everybody Diana, can
but
make
don't,
this.
Don't be unfair on yourself, because yeah. I was actually talking to, shout out to Daniel Prince. He was a very influential person in my life at a particular time that's very important for me. And he came on my old podcast, and he talked me about, like, when he, after 16 years as an FX broker, decided to quit, and he'd read Tim Ferriss's 4-Hour Workweek book. Mm-hmm. And the particular part of that book that he loved was called Failure Setting. And so often, and I encourage anyone to go and get the book, and actually don't read any of it, just go to the Failure Setting section. It was very effective for me as well. But like, you've got these dreams, aspirations, visions, and we don't do anything about them because they're like too risky, right?
Yeah.
And if you go and do some work, which is essentially like, what's the worst thing that can happen? And more often than not, you write down 15 things. And when you start picking them to pieces, they're like just complete rubbish. And in Daniel's case, he would talk about how he thought he'd be destitute under a bridge with his four kids and wife. He's like, well, if I quit my job and don't make any money for a year, I've still got my parents and my wife's still got her parents and we've all got siblings and they all own their own houses.
Yes.
But people would have us to come and stay. And so it's that sense of actually you don't really look at how risky it is. And I found that very helpful. So if anyone's out there thinking about diving down and doing something, like what's the worst thing that can happen?
Yes.
And I bet what you write down is extremely unlikely. And okay, Diana, so you mentioned a nonprofit. So what's the nonprofit that you're running?
This is the Bitcoin Indonesia Initiative. So where we educate people about Bitcoin all for free. So we never charge people for joining our events, for joining our classes. It's all for free.
Cool. And actually, I think it was the Bitcoin Indonesia website that I was able to send to Ronnie that was obviously in Bahasa. He's suddenly like, oh, sweet. Now I can see what's going on.
Yes.
How cool. And so, okay. And on top of that then, well, let's stick on that for a moment. So how do you run a nonprofit? Are there many people involved? And do you have to raise finance somehow to get the whole thing to actually function? Just teach us a little bit about what life is like running a nonprofit.
Mm-hmm. So when we started, we were so passionate about everything that we used lots of our private money to make this happen and to build a Bitcoin house, to print all these materials, to go to schools and run these workshops. So in the beginning, yes, it was our private money. We started with four co-founders, and now we have a core team of six people. And Indonesia-wide, it's probably over 20 people that are working on this project because we are having 36 meetups every single month that are happening across Indonesia.
Wow.
So it's a big team, and definitely financials is the biggest problem because when you start a project like this, nobody really knew us. So we did not really have a reputation. We had no proof of work. We were just like four passionate Bitcoiners that wanted to change the world. So you first need to earn trust before you can apply for grants, for example. So what helped us a lot was creating the Geyser Fund, because via Geyser, you can just get some money in from the community and people buy into your project. They don't really care about yourself, right? So it's easier to get some money from the community to get started. And then you can do the proof of work and apply for grants. So nowadays we are funded by Human Rights Foundation, Block, OpenSets, and PayStand. These are our big donors.
Interesting. And so do you have to have a kind of annual meet with those kind of organizations and update them as to what you've been up to? And it's essentially no, well, they're probably different structures. So do you just literally just get a grant with no ties, or they say, here's some money, but you must do X, Y, Z?
The way it works is that you write a proposal and you pitch them what you want to do and what money you need to buy things, to print books, whatever it is. So you write down milestones and then all the costs, you're like budgeting. And I write a monthly reporting for all of these grant givers to keep transparency. They don't really request this. There's lots of trust involved.
Yeah.
And some request a quarterly reporting, but I just do it every month because also we like to see what we have achieved in 1 month.
Yeah. What are some of the most important metrics that you're following each month?
So we write down how many meetups we organized, what kind of workshops we hosted, what kind of content we've created. Sometimes we write books, we write articles, we translate applications, we open source everything, and how many merchants we've onboarded, all of these things.
It's really cool, actually. And it's getting me thinking because labels are annoying at times, but I am an investor and I have become an investor over the last 15 years because of the personal situation I found myself in, which is a story most listeners will have heard, but you may not have done, which is that my father died sadly when he was only 48 and he was a wealthy guy. I inherited his property which we then sold. And so I basically received an inheritance in my 20s. And it's like, what do you do with it? And I went down this whole journey of trying to figure that question out. And eventually, Bitcoin just became this bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger part of it. To now, where it's like, well, the portfolio shows Bitcoin at 80% or something of everything else. And I go to conferences and I have a podcast. And, you know, it just, it's become this extraordinary thing where it's become a huge part of my life. Mm-hmm. And it's because it's incredible at what it does. As a savings technology, you don't need to be an investor. You're not taking risk. It's just money. No one can take it off you. And it's incredibly important technology. But I have spent time doing things like angel investing. So you take money and you're putting capital into early stage startups, for example, or you could buy equity in a publicly traded company, etc. There's lots of different ways of doing things. But to my mind, what you're just describing, that is philanthropy. Mm-hmm. So it's how philanthropy should be, mm-hmm. not some kind of gazillionaire who has a personal agenda where they're able to own equity in a bunch of companies that they then get regulated into existence because of, you know, before we even go, need to go down that rabbit hole, right, of like punting fake food at people and everything else.
Yeah.
This sounds awesome. So essentially, people are out there that are willing to give funds to Bitcoin-oriented projects, and they can do it through the Human Rights Foundation, or they can do it through OpenSats, for example.
Yes.
And like, it's very, very, very hard to outpace Bitcoin. So Bitcoin's the hurdle rate. So if anyone's out there that's got an investment opportunity that might outpace Bitcoin, tell me, because I'm interested. But actually, maybe another way of looking at this is you just sit on your Bitcoin stack, and as it grows in purchasing power, whatever the increase might be that you don't need for daily life, well, mm-hmm. you could funnel it into someone like Bitcoin Indonesia and yourself, Dion. So it's a really cool thing to hear about. And the more professional a product you create, the more capital you will attract. So a monthly report, for example, how cool. I'd love to know what, you know.
I can send you some if you're interested.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, why not?
What I've noticed is that there are many Bitcoiners who got into Bitcoin quite early or were just sitting on a like big stack of Bitcoin, and they want to see adoption, but they don't want to do the work.
Yes.
And then there are communities or people like us that want to do the work, but they don't have the money. So these grants or Geyser is just a great way to connect those different groups and give those power that want to do the education and the dirty work on the ground. And I think it's a great opportunity to send money across the globe and to empower communities.
And it's really getting my lots of ideas flowing, because in some ways you could have, or just for myself, I could have I'd have a way of helping people that's very, very obvious to me, because mm-hmm. I know that Bitcoin advocacy is the most important thing to human empowerment, essentially, for the individual. And so if I can find places to put capital that help do that in multiple locations, that would be epic.
Yeah.
And you'd have proof for that, right? You know, your monthly report might come through, or whatever the case is. Okay, awesome. I didn't expect to learn this on this podcast. So,
you're welcome. And you can also, deduct this from your taxes, so you don't pay taxes, you just donate to Bitcoin projects.
Yeah, cool. Okay, so there's a tax efficiency play as well.
Yeah.
Cool. Let me speak to my accountant about how this might work. And it's funny, because you mentioned earlier, I can so see this as well, and I was guilty of this too. So I was in my like late 20s. Mm-hmm. I was working in the shipping industry. I was living in Singapore. I was helping move vast quantities of raw materials around the world, like iron ore and coal. And I grew completely jaded with my job. And I was looking closely at technology. I was like, wow, you can now put a solar panel on a roof in an African hut. Like, you don't need a coal power station. You don't need to dig it out of the ground in Australia and ship it to China and burn it to create electricity. Like, this is just mental. At the same time, I was consuming a lot of like climate change type stuff. So this would have been about 2015, 2016 type era, 2017. And at one point, like, I made some very big life decisions around, I want to only work on sustainability. Like, mm-hmm. this is one thing that I had to go and do. And above all else, that was the most important. Now, I still flew all over the place. I still, like, individual actions didn't necessarily change, but I thought that I could use capital and my career to influence things. Mm-hmm. And Bitcoin came along and basically hit me like a ton of bricks. And in hindsight, I was just an idiot about, like, what was actually going on, to be honest, where it's like, if you use a plastic straw or not, it's not going to change anything. If there's inflationary monetary supply, it completely screws with the long-term thinking of people. And when I came across time preference, I was like, hang on a sec. And because I'd been looking for, like, technology products that disrupt, like, mm-hmm. disruption was something I really understood. And when I first heard the phrase Bitcoin disrupts central banks, I was like, whoa, that is spicy. What does that mean? And then, you know, 2020 happened and all the craziness with the money printing, etc. Plus, MicroStrategy start buying on their balance sheet. It's like, hang on, think of all the lawyers they must have, all the accountants they've got, their stock listed company, and they just did it. This is big deal. And that's really where I started taking a lot more professional attention. But I'm just re-envisaging myself. It's probably similar to yourself in a suit, working for a consultancy with a nice car, worrying about all these things that, you know, you're reading it from someone somewhere.
Yeah.
Inequality, what a nightmare. And you're like, oh, I must do something about this. But every day you go to work for a large corporation of something.
Yeah. It's so
and it's stupid. Like, it doesn't make sense. Where am I going with all this? Like, Bitcoin fixes this.
100%. Right? What you just said resonates so much with me because me and my partner, we used to go to the beach in the morning and collect trash, like plastic from the beach. And then the next day we came back, it was all full again. So we started again.
Mm.
And at one point we noticed, what are we doing here? This will not change anything. We better go to our Bitcoin house and we educate people about solid money. And this will, in the long term, change problems like this. But if we only focus on these tiny things and do not change the whole system, we will not have impact.
Hmm. Again, to talk about time preference, like you're able to zoom out and think about things on a more long-term basis as a result of sound money. Mm-hmm. And Bitcoin is the latest iteration of sound money. And so you adopt Bitcoin, you adopt sound money, you adopt a low time preference thinking. 100%. And what that means is you think a lot stronger about how you spend your money, just to start with, right? So normally you get your $100, that pair of Nikes is going to be 120 next year. So I'm just going to buy them now. And so the inflationary monetary system pushes consumerism to levels never seen before. And the whole system is incentivized to spend today rather than save to tomorrow. But when you get closer to Bitcoin, you're incentivized to actually not spend, but save for tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And people are always like, oh, you can't have that. Economy will die. And it's like, well, I still spend, but just on different things and on different time horizons, right?
Yes.
Stuff is still valuable to me at a certain price point when my objectives change. And that whole idea of value being subjective, it really hits home so hard. But what you've described here, I think, is so cool, is there's people out there that will call them human rights activists,
mm-hmm.
but they use fiat currency.
Yeah.
And you're like, that actually doesn't make sense, guys. And here's why. And normally they'll be like, you're talking about Bitcoin. It's a scam. It boils the oceans. You know what I mean? And they're just not interested. And that's okay.
Yeah.
But if you did make donations or grants or whatever the right phrase might be to, you know, 5 or 10 organizations around the world building stuff like yourself, you're going to have an impact on inequality. You're going to have an impact on financial privilege. You're going to have an impact on individual choice.
Yeah.
And I mean, how incredible is that versus what the charity system works normally? Wow. And have you found it difficult raising funds?
Yeah, so we were struggling a lot in the beginning, as I've mentioned. And many times we were very close to shutting down everything because we were running out of money. And especially before we got the big grants, it was difficult because we were so pushing so much and we had so many ideas and we were like overworked spending our private money. And like, then you sometimes question yourself, why am I doing this? This is stupid. On the other side, you cannot really stop. So yeah, raising money is not an easy task. And also with these grants, they are mainly 1 year grant. So they give you money for 1 year and then you have to apply again. So also this month we need to apply for new grants to secure our project basically. And it's hard for you to think long term and to grow a team if you never know how long you can pay them. So this is a big challenge for us.
Interesting.
We don't want to stop, but yeah.
Put it this way. I'm very confident you'll find the money. One thing I'd love to get your view on is you take a step back and you start to see the world for what it is, the incentive of the money printer creates a whole lot of misalignment that affects the healthcare system, affects the education system, and absolutely everything it touches, including the world of charity. Mm-hmm. And even the idea of a philanthropist, I think, is being completely bastardized into this basically like multi-billionaire type, I'm going to play God and you're going to praise me for it type thing. Yeah. Putting aside that, because it's easy to just like throw blame at it. But it's obvious to me, right, that if someone has a money printer, they can give money to their buddies first. And they go, look, just here's the money, but say what I want. And so in a world of grants, how do things change in a Bitcoin-denominated financing system? So in this instance, people are giving you grants to continue Bitcoin advocacy work, whether that's, you know, education on a Friday night or going to the school or whatever different projects you're running. Mm-hmm. But the Bitcoin donors are aligned with the output of that from a very simple, like, because Bitcoin's getting adopted, everyone's happy.
Mm-hmm.
That would be my take, at least. Whereas, mm-hmm. like, if I print a dollar and then tell the education system to behave in a certain way and tell everyone that they coach to think a certain way, like when you start thinking about like how the universities of today basically just propaganda machines for the government. Yeah. And that alignment suits the person with the money printer, but not necessarily the end user. Mm-hmm. Like, you're the product. It's mm-hmm. like, mate, you're going to be a taxpayer forever and we're going to stealth tax you with inflation and you're going to think that you're free and really happy, but actually you're getting screwed.
Mm-hmm.
Does that change the dynamic when it's like a Bitcoin kind of, it's basically it's charity on a Bitcoin standard?
Mm-hmm. Mm. So I'm not really sure if I get your question 100%. The question is if
people... Well, I guess it's my my read of the traditional system, when there's the ability to print money, it means that you can basically print your own money and then influence people's thinking
mm-hmm.
with your money. In a world of Bitcoin, that's not possible.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, the way that money is then donated, it's not going to be with the same, like, you must think a certain way in order to get this money.
Mm-hmm. Yes, 100%. I also think that all these projects that are funded by these big organizations, they are very independent. There's no agenda. There's nothing they tell us what we need to do. They really trust us that we know best how to have impact, how to tackle the community, how to adjust Bitcoin education to the local circumstances. So it's a very decentralized approach, in my opinion. It's really giving back power to the people and not, yeah, following in some kind of agenda. And this is why all these projects around the world are so diverse. And it's amazing because last year we went to the Bitcoin Beach Summit where circular economies from all over the world met. And everybody of us has such a different approach and so many different learnings and different challenges. And of course, we can all learn from each other, but it's great that we have the opportunity to stay independent and do what we think is best.
So cool. Sorry, what was that event you went to?
The Bitcoin Beach Circular Economy Summit.
Wow. And so how many different communities from around the world were there?
I don't know the exact number. I don't want to lie. Let's say 15.
Really?
Wow. Yeah, it was a very, very diverse crowd. It was very cool.
But again, so fun to see how, like, it's just so bottom up, isn't it, Bitcoin? It's just being adopted at a local level, at an individual level. And that,
yeah.
that kind of that manifests in different ways in different locations.
Yeah.
Awesome. And well, Diana, thank you so much for your time. Oh, please, please carry on.
Yes. No, you just mentioned that in the current school system, people just learn what basically the government wants them to know.
Mm.
And I never really, like in Germany, we always had discussion in school. I don't want to say that the German school system is the best, but we were like taught to be open-minded and to have different opinions and to argue and to stand up for our opinion. And then we started teaching my first Bitcoin here in Bali, and there were lots of local students. And for them, it was the first time in their life that they had discussions in the class and that they had to argue, and that we were like comparing things and asked them, what's your opinion on this? And they told us, this is so different to what we're used to, because they always read the book, they learn by heart, and they repeat.
Wow.
And only this was like, for me, one of the best experiences I had here. Seeing that people get the chance to argue and to get a new point of view on topics.
Cool. Yeah. And that's, it's just, yeah, it's very, very empowering, isn't it?
Yeah. Cool.
And it's, well, yes, to, I don't want to give that such a broad statement. It's been very empowering for me. And when I see it in myself, I can start seeing it in lots of other places too. Yeah, cool. Okay, well, Diana, wish you the very, very best of luck with the conference, and everything you're building sounds fantastic. So if people want to reach out and find out anything or just get in touch, what's the best way for them to reach out?
Maybe via Twitter. So my personal account is BulleBitcoin, or you find us with BTC House Bali.
And we'll link that in the show notes as well for anyone that needs to find you. Well, thank you so much for your time, Diana.
Thank you. It was so much fun talking to you.
Thank you.